You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Pablo, DC, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for coming, and thanks for your work. We've got a hard stop in about 56 minutes, so let's just jump right up into it. You guys went a bit viral last month because you're showing how easy it is to buy fentanyl with food stamps in San Francisco. Why did you guys decide to go make this video to prove this particular route to fentanyl acquisition exists?
I can jump in on this. Yeah, Marty, thanks for having me. Long time listener, first time caller. We started basically Civics Club in San Francisco, trying to find ways to help the city and just make it like the best place possible. It is very rare that we had like such amount of wealth creation in a city, and like things have degraded. And we just like, it's just a side project with a bunch of friends who all have, you know, day jobs. We all take time off our jobs to put in time to find ways to help the city. And we have different projects in the works. One of them was that we stumbled into a lot of fraud that was happening just by, you know, sniffing around. And we just wanted to show it to people and say like, hey, like we think the best disinfectant is like the you know, sunlight. And if we have any chance on improving the city, the best, like the order of business, first order of business is, you know, plug the holes where like the water is flowing out, and, then, you know, pour in clean water later.
You know, I can speak a bit to like how we ran into this too. You know, Mario, have you ever been in a developing country and you kind of you come out of the airport or the train station and there's people like taxi, and they're hassling you to get sell you something?
Yes. Yeah, Costa Rica and Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah. Yes. New Jersey, of course. They come with their hair slicked back. We basically experienced this at the farmer's market. You know, like you go to the farmer's market in SF and specific ones in particular, and you can just see, you know, these people, you know, a lot of them like, you know, sort of older ladies, funnily enough, like, and you can see them doing this to people who have the EBT paper coupons, and you know, they're like sell, chasing them around. And this is how we got down this road of like, what's going on here, right? And we ended up going to the farmer market basically every week, every Sunday, for a couple months. And we, you know, we had some cameras, we had friends. One funny thing that's not widely known, by the way, about like, you know, food stamps is they are not acid tested. How many assets you have is like not part of the eligibility criteria, which means if you like, you know, just quit your job at Google and you're starting at Facebook in 6 months, technically during those 6 months, you're eligible for food stamps. Right. So one, you know, like friend of ours basically got an EBT card, perfectly legit, all accurate, and went there. And, you know, they give you one interesting thing about EBT that we should say is the surveillance on it is quite good in normal places. If you go to a Walmart and you try to buy a non-EBT eligible item and pay for it with food stamps, it won't work at all. It's all tracked at the point of checkout. There's this beautiful national system called Alert that like, you know, tracks SNAP usage, But the big loophole of the farmer market is they'll give you paper coupons, you know, for an EBT swipe. And not only that, but they have these other matching funds we talked about a bit in our video that get sort of blended in to the, so, you know, you can turn, take, say, you know, 30 bucks of food stamp from your EBT, get 90 bucks of paper coupons. Now it's untraceable because it's paper. And there's this whole sort of ecosystem of people who are there who are willing to buy that from you for, let's say, 45 bucks. You know, now you have, you've turned 30 bucks of food stamp balance into 45 bucks cash.
It's insane. And how prevalent is this in terms of an acquisition mechanism for drugs specifically?
Yeah. You know, we the other angle that we had on this is we went and we just interviewed a number of street addicts. People, by the way, people like to say, you know, homeless. That's sort of like, but a lot of them actually aren't homeless.
They have homes. Yeah.
Exactly. Like a lot of them are in these, what are called SROs, which is single room occupancy, which is basically, you know, government provided housing. And a lot of, and, you know, we'll get into this a little bit later, but one crazy thing, really crazy thing in California is you, like, by state law, they don't do state funding for sober housing. You know, they call it housing first, which means like, yeah, you know, we fund these SROs and people explicitly who are still like actively, you know, using drugs are allowed in these buildings to live in these buildings. You can imagine how hard this is for people who are trying to get clean. They're now next to people who are doing it. And so a lot of them are not even actually homeless. They're street addicts. They're like, you know, in there at night, they're out during the day or other way around in many cases, getting their fix. And what we found is if you just walk up to them and like offer them a coffee, right? A lot of them are really happy to talk to someone who is sort of connecting them in a human way, like not just as like, you know, a cop or a caseworker or whatever. And, you know, you take them to the corner store, we both get a coffee. They're happy to just volunteer like the whole story. They're like, yeah, you know, here's how much it costs me every month to buy the, you know, Fent. Here's how like I get my funding. You know, I use my food stamps, you know, I don't need that because you get free food at this other place. And like, they'll just walk you through the whole story. And it is very sad because, you know, you can kind of see how they're being farmed in a sense. It's like, you know, you have all of these, like this whole like NGO complex that's like, you know, a bunch of pretty well-paid people who like are like, you know, sort of do good or presenting, but they're like actively enabling these guys' addictions.
Yeah. The worst part is when you jump into that
do good or NGO. This is a big scale. Ooh. Go ahead, Bobo.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, like, the worst part, like what it is really heartbreaking is when we started meeting the moms of a lot of guys that are out in the street. And, like, that's a rough one. Because, like, it is very, look, it's not great when you're in the bus and there's like a crazy person screaming at you and like throwing poop or something. But it is a different, like you get a different side of the story when you hear about her mom, like that, like this guy's mom who like he's out in the street, like a crazy person or like on crazy drugs, but they have, you know, they have families. At some point they were five and they were a kid, right? And like you talk to the mom and see the pictures of the guy when he was a kid, and it's like it's really rough. I mean, yeah, these people shouldn't be demonized. Like they're like they need help, but like what they're receiving.
He might be breaking up on us. We might be losing him.
Well, the good thing is with this,
but what they're receiving locally, is not help. Yeah. But what they're receiving is not help. It's just like what they're receiving from the NGOs is like they're being enabled to do more drugs.
How did you get in contact with some of their mothers?
So you asked how did we get in contact with the moms? There's this amazing organization actually, and you know we found them afterwards as a result of doing this investigation. They're called Mothers Against Drug Deaths, And it's, they're working really, I think they're a really great organization. They're basically, one of their big things that they're pushing on right now is fixing that sober housing law that we were talking about, you know, hey, actually it's totally insane that we, you know, specifically require these sort of like, you know, permanent supportive housing to be like drugs allowed, you know, like we should be able to fund sober housing. We should be doing that instead. And they all, like every one of them has like a kid who either is currently addicted or like was addicted and has recovered. They have some really powerful stories. I think one of the like most poignant that I saw was, one of the moms was telling us about like, you know, how basically she was like scrolling Facebook, you know, and she'd been like having this struggle for years with her son, was like, you know, had a hard time, was sort of like in drugs, in remission, or what's it called, you know, recovery, relapse, right? And there's this, you know, video on the Facebook wall of a guy on BART, which is the train system here in SF. Like, you know, sort of like passed out next to like a, you know, a puddle of puke. And there's like all of these guys in the comments, you know, saying mean things. They're like, oh, you know, this, like, this is what happens when we like, don't, you know, like have order on the train, like don't enforce the laws. Like, you know, this is fucked up. And it is obviously objectively, there's some people being like mean about it. And she goes in there and she's like, that's him, right? So she put a comment, be like, this is, I've been looking for him. This is my son. And a bunch of those same people who had commented like, you know, sort of nasty things about him, like replied to that. And they're like, we're so sorry. That's really messed up. You know, like we that you can, you know, like people have this sort of like, I think dual thing. And it's very sad that you see it where it's like, you know, learned helplessness. It's like, okay, this stuff is like really destroying our public space, but you know, whatever, there's nothing we can do about it. And that turns into like a sort of callousness. You know, you see people who are like really having a bad time and you don't really see them as like a person versus like as like a disturbance, right? But you know, I think there's this like really sort of unfortunate dynamic, at least so far in the Bay Area, where people, all of the let's be compassionate to the homeless people, like it boils down to like, let them keep doing drugs. And so Mothers Against Drug Deaths, I think, is a really powerful organization because they're like, you know, no, how about we like, you know, actually, you know, crack down on the drug use, like, you know, get people like into involuntary treatment, like do treatment first instead of housing first, like all of these things, because like they actually care about their kids getting out of this.
Yeah. I mean, that gets to the key question. Is this problem been allowed to persist because of bad policy that comes from a good place, or is the intended policy, well, not maybe the explicit, but the implicit
totally.
Policy to continue a degradation of civility in public spaces to force the state of California to step in and demand more tax dollars to try to fix this, so totally. Money can be funneled to cronies and NGOs and other agencies.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's a lot of both. Pablo, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think it is a dual problem on the government side and on the NGO side. They're kind of like, but I think the winning thing to get like the problem fixed is, I think, on the ground, sort of like with like civilians that like see the problem up close and like are directly affected, and like amplifying that voice as much as possible. And I think even there, I'm sure there's certainly like bad actors in like NGOs and government officials, but they're also like good people that, you know, actually do care. And they're like, hey, like there is another way. Like, we like look at this guy, look at like here, listen to the story of like the moms and like look at like how ridiculous it is to actually get drugs with like government money. If we close this loop, we can get help these people actually. And yes, there should probably be some crackdown on anyone who's doing like bad, like illegal stuff or like funneling money in like a bad way. But I wouldn't like go out and say like that everyone in the government is like terrible and everyone in the NGOs is like a terrible person. Like, I'm sure they're good people, but I think there are sort of like these perverse incentives in which maybe their bosses are like blinded to like what the situation on the ground is and how it's not like it has improved somewhat with the new mayor. I would say with Lurie, like basically all the things that matter have improved. In my opinion, they could go faster and they could go like even deeper, but yeah, and that's what I would say.
So, freaks, this work was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. Guys, things happen, things get lost. You need to replace your phone. Life happens, and BitKey has been designed with this in mind. So if you're looking for the easiest way to secure your Bitcoin off the exchange, go get a BitKey. It doesn't come with any seed phrases. There's no single point of failure. It's a 2-3 multi-sig. You have your device, you have the mobile app, and Block stores a key in the server. So you have collaborative multi-sig there. On top of that, the new BitKey has a screen, so you can actually see and verify what you're approving. You can look at transactions, addresses, account changes. The difference between trusting and knowing has been built into the new BitKey with the screen. They have changed code delegation and other advanced features like inheritance, recovery. If you're looking to get your Bitcoin off exchange, you haven't done so, you're looking for the easiest way to do that, go get a BitKey. You can use our code today, TFTC, to get 10% off the new BitKey. So go download the BitKey app. Use the code TFTC to get 10% off the new BitKey and start your self-custody journey today. This episode has been sponsored by our good friends at BitKey. What's up, freaks? This rip is brought to you by our good friends at CrowdHealth. I've been a happy CrowdHealth member for almost 5 years now. My wife and I have had 2 children while we've been on CrowdHealth, and I actually just got the last bill for our third child funded. It was $6,157. CrowdHealth negotiated down to $2,309, and we only paid $500. The rest was crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth Network. If you're sick of health insurance premiums and having to pay deductibles and getting ripped off at the hospital, join CrowdHealth. It's an alternative way to pay for your healthcare. It's not health insurance, it's crowdfunded healthcare. As you can tell, they negotiate prices for you. You pay in cash. It's much cheaper. Overall, we're much happier. They have incredible perks. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC to sign up. 5 years on CrowdHealth, not looking back. Join crowdhealth.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC. Once you set up your account, you're going to get $99 a month for your subscription for the first 3 months.
I'll just say anecdotally, I've been to San Francisco 3 times in the last 10 years. 2016, went with my wife and her family. We went to wine country for a weekend and spent a day in San Francisco. I think it was like MLK Day. We spent the Monday there. We parked our car in Golden Gate Park, got robbed immediately, took all of our luggage, our passports and stuff. 2019. Wow.
That's horrible, man.
2019, went back to wine country with my wife, just the two of us. We stayed at a hotel in San Francisco the night before we drove up to Napa. And as soon as we get out of the Uber, there's some guy pleasuring himself on the steps of the hotel that we were staying at. I was like, oh, welcome back to San Francisco.
Right.
I would say the last time I was there was November of last year. Granted, I was staying in the Presidio, but I had some time to walk around. It was much better. I didn't see. There's actually a fourth time I was in there in 2018. I actually walked from the top of the hill down through the Tenderloin and towards Market Street to Squares headquarters. Yeah, that was the worst I saw up close and personal. But when I was there in November, it actually seemed better than it was in 2019, the last time I was there.
Man, the new mayor is quite great. I think he might have the highest approval rating of any mayor in the city.
In the country, yes.
Any mayor in the city. pretty sure he has the highest approval rating of any mayor in the city.
Yeah, high in the country, because, you know, it's just, there's still a long way to go. Like, I think, you know, we can get into this a bit later too. I think, you know, one thing that Pablo and I and our friends have been thinking a lot about is like, you know, what does it take to have like real, you know, civic ambition, you know, like not just like, oh, you know, fix this problem, make that like parking situation a little better, but like, hey, actually, you know, with like how productive SF is, it should be like a really like great world city. It should be like something that people go and say, you know, like, wow, in a good way, you know, not just like not wow in a bad way.
Yeah. And Pablo, I think this is what we've bonded over, over the years. I mean, it's your love of aesthetics and bringing back beauty into the world, which, I mean, the lived environment and the physical environment affects how you react physically and mentally as an individual. And to this point, I mean, walking through I avoided San Francisco for 6 years because of that physical reality situation that I experienced over multiple trips, which was nothing to do with the architecture, but like literally with filth on the streets and being accosted by homeless people either pleasuring themselves or trying to steal our luggage.
Yep. Many, many such cases.
Yeah. I would say that San Francisco is, to me, as a non-US citizen, a person who's here, like visiting, it feels to me that San Francisco is like the crown jewel of like American cities. It's just like so beautiful. The problem is that it many times has been mismanaged, and that makes sort of like it makes the mismanagement worse in some way. The fact that you're mismanaging like one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and the other problem I think is that I think the Victorian houses are so incredibly beautiful, and like the city itself is so like it's striking. It's like the beauty is really striking. It sort of created this weird sort of checkmate situation,
juxtaposition,
sort of like of people not wanting to build, and just like, oh no, like, we should keep it as is, like not disturb it. And I think the YIMBYs, for the most part, should embrace the fact that we should build more, but we should be more in an affordable way, but also like way more beautiful, and like sort of like it should feel like a definite like the next level of like a civilization that we should build. And you can't achieve that if you're not thinking that like beauty needs to be a center of that. And not just like random stuff that you think is beautiful, but something that is like tethered to like the heritage of the place, but also has a view of the future of like, we know where we're going. We have a certain view of how the world should be, and it's going to be great for everyone. And you're going to get on board because like, once you see it, like you're going to fall in love with it, and you're going to want to be like where we're going. And that gets people excited. And it, as long as sort of it's this vision of like, not only are we trying to make like the best, we're also trying to include everyone. You can get everyone on board. As long as you're making stuff that is beautiful and affordable, like you can also make stuff that is not affordable in certain parts of the city. And that sort of like has this weird effect of like the sponge that takes sort of like the demand of the people who are super wealthy, and the prices of all the other stuff go down. So like either way, even if you like you don't have to only build affordable housing for the cost of living in San Francisco to go down, which is now, I would say, the major problem in San Francisco. The homelessness and the like, I'm sorry, I won't use the euphemisms. It's not a homelessness problem. The drug problem in San Francisco has improved. It is still a big problem that needs to be addressed. That's for sure. It's not like we're living, you know, in like Tokyo, in which like there are no homeless in the street. There are homeless in the street, and that needs to be addressed. But housing is now the thing that is like like just extremely painful for people, especially young people. If you've lived in San Francisco for 50 years and you own a home, you feel like you're the smartest person in the world. You bought a home for like nothing, and like an Anthropic employee and an OpenAI employee are in this insane bidding war to buy your home for millions of dollars, and you bought it for nothing. Like, you feel like the smartest person ever. And it just creates this like situation in which if you're young and you're not like ultra wealthy, you're like screwed. And it's terrible for like starting families and people at the beginning of their careers. So I think the angle there is not to say like either you shouldn't. I don't think the way out is to villainize like the people who own homes, or even like the people that made a lot of money in tech and they're trying to buy homes. The way out is like we just need to convince both that we need to build like big and beautiful so that like just everyone wins. And on top of that, the people who are priced out of San Francisco can also enjoy it and like build families.
Well, how do we get back to that? Obviously, you have this NIMBYism that exists.
Totally.
And I think to your point about the Victorians in San Francisco being objectively beautiful, and a lot of people not wanting to disturb that, I think that's the bit because we've lost our way.
What we're going to do is we're going to make beautiful Greco-futurism renders. They're going to strike them of how beautiful everything is. And we're going to convince them that they need to be real. And we need to do everything in our power to make it real, because they're going to be so beautiful that they won't be able to help themselves but want it.
I agree. I mean, if you're not following Pablo, go follow him on X. It'll be in the show description. But I mean, you've been tweeting Greco. These Greco renderings for many years now, and it's like, how do you actually go from that rendering to the reality? How do you convince developers specifically?
Well, we have a first project in the works, a monument that I designed for Aaron Schwartz, an internet hero that had a very strong values for an open internet, sort of a Discord internet values that most tech people, I would say most people believe, but they just need to be reminded of, which is freedom of speech, freedom of access to information, and privacy. Sort of like these three core values kind of counterbalance each other. And the plan is to have sort of like this, a new style really of like beauty, and that is tethered to our humanity, that has a strong idea of the future, and have this monument that has a marble bust that I had made of him that is currently at the Internet Archive installed on top of the monument. Sort of like it's sort of this stone bench that is inviting for people to sit on and admire the skyline of San Francisco. And that is sort of like the first beacon of like, hey, like we want to create this future that is like human and that has a connection to beauty, and it's sort of like this counter vision of what many times tech is now. So the plan is to have the monument face Salesforce Tower. Sort of have it this sort of like two competing visions of tech, of like, do you want the corporate for profit, or you want the open source nonprofit? Sort of like do you want the glass towering structure, or do you want the inviting stone bench at a human scale? And so that's the angle to try to, as a first project, sort of make it real and like show people it's like, okay, this is where we want to go.
Yeah, totally. The Aaron monument is going to be really beautiful. It's going to be like, you know, actual stone. It's going to be Greco-futuristic. I think zoomed out like one step from this is you need existence proofs. You need proofs that this is possible, because one of the, you know, I think if you really zoom all the way out, San Francisco is very unique in that it is basically like kind of like spring loaded for greatness. There's like a lot of very smart people here. There's a lot of resources. There's a lot of capability. A lot of people who really know how to get stuff done. And yet, if you look at an aerial photo, SF today looks almost exactly the same as it did 70 years ago. You know, there's like the Salesforce Tower is new, like, but it's like, it's not inspiring and it's very few things. And one part of the reason for that is because, you know, there's, everyone sort of implicitly assumes it can't be done. There's a bunch of people in SF who are like, yeah, you know, we can, you know, build a billion-dollar company. We can build like a, you know, fully autonomous robot factory in like, you know, the middle of the desert in Nevada. We can go to space, but like, you know, building a few buildings, like nice big buildings next to Golden Gate Park, like the ones you see next to Central Park, impossible. Don't even think about that. And like, until you bust through that with like existence proofs, you know, a statue, an actual building later that exists that like, you know, shows people like, actually, yeah, you can make beautiful things. There's no law against it. It doesn't have to be like a thing that looks like a stack of Lego cubes. Like, you know, that's how you, I think you get like the real, like, you know, sort of snowball rolling on this.
Yeah. The Greco futurists is very inspiring. And there's another, like, because that's what I worry about, like the again, going back to like the contractors, people that actually build these buildings, there's very few people that think about aesthetics. And I think DC, I'm not sure how familiar you are with like this show and like the intersection of Bitcoin and urbanism, but it comes back to like time preference. Like a lot of these builders
are incentivized
to just get the cheapest materials, throw something up, use something cookie cutter because it's cheap, fast. And like, how do we, like, I think the 1,000-year home guys, everybody working on the brick masonry, revitalism in the middle of America are doing an incredible job to bring back beautiful aesthetics to small neighborhoods. But when it comes to building larger buildings in cities, like this Greco futurist aesthetic that you're really refining, Pablo, is something that is inspiring and hopeful to me and something that I wish people would go after. But it's like, how do you convince these guys? And it was encouraging to see Spencer Pratt, I think in one of his recent interviews, saying that they're going to begin bringing Art Deco back to Los Angeles.
Amazing.
Do you think there's a market there on the contractor side to actually go build these things?
Well, I'll push back a little bit here just for the fun of it, Dan. I don't know if we can go back to Art Deco. I don't know if there's any going back at all at in general. The arrow history moves in one direction. Overall, right. there are cycles, but overall they are like the line, like it, like the future should look like the future. And we shouldn't LARP the past. We should learn from it and we should revive it whenever it's needed and like have, it's a revival is different from LARPing. A revival is like animating it back and actually finding new ways in which it fits in within your time. We don't want to live in a Renaissance fair. That's lame. We don't want to live in Disney World, right? We want to live in a real place. And being in a real place, it should feel like it's new and it's like authentic and that it is new, but also tethered to the history of the place.
Who are the young builders who are going to do this? That's my question.
You know, I don't know if they're like exactly the ones that are going to do it in SF, but have you seen the American Housing Corporation?
I have not, no.
Great. They're friends of mine. Great.
There's a Twitter account called @YimbyLand.
I'm familiar with that account.
He's one of the founders they're really doing, I think, amazing work of like make something that is sort of, you know, human, family oriented, aesthetically aspirational, but also something that can be constructed quickly. Because this is the other thing, I think, very important to like do the existence proof to show people it can be done is like, you know, you can actually build housing in like less than a decade in SF. It's not going to be easy, but if you have like, you know, sort of like enough chutzpah and will and like you really line things up, I think you can do this it much faster than people assume it can be done. Because if it's like, oh, you know, it's this thing that's going to take forever, maybe in 2037 we'll have this thing, you know, it's impossible to build momentum and excitement around that. Mm-hmm. So they're really doing great work on like tight timelines, and I'm excited about them.
Yeah. I would say the other two other companies that I like on this is famous one, Monument Labs in New York. I think they're doing great work. I work with them for the Aaron bust. And yeah, Mike is fantastic. I know another guy in London who has a very similar angle. He uses similar machines. It has a different software technology called Gonder Industries. I also like them. The Housing Corporation is fantastic. I'm a huge fan of what those guys are doing in Austin. You're in Austin, right? All right. So you should meet those guys. You're in Texas, no?
Not anymore. I moved back to Philadelphia, where I'm from. Spoiled with beautiful architecture. With sprinkled in terrible architecture from the last three decades. But that's what. No, I moved back to be closer to family, and we actually just bought like a 112-year-old house. It's like amazing. Stone, and part of the reason why was like the aesthetics, and it's been around for 100 years. It's got Lindy, and it's got very good bones, and we don't have to do much to it. We are going to revitalize it to a certain extent, but part of the reason we moved back is you can find one of these homes that's relatively affordable and is beautiful on top of. It's secondary to being closer to family, but I feel very fortunate and lucky that we were able to find this house and lock it down. And to your point, Pablo, like we need to, like this is a 112-year-old house. We probably shouldn't rebuild this house for moving forward, but like really diving into the idea of build for the future. Don't try to LARP. We don't want to create like a Renaissance fair world.
It's different from an actual Renaissance. What you want is an actual like Italian Renaissance. That's what you want, and that's what like the people in the Renaissance figured out. That's what like the greatest merchants of history, the ones in Florence and Venice, they realized that like their legitimacy was not they had no legitimacy on like the rulers of all their Europes that. Like we're basically kings appointed by God because they won a bunch of wars. The merchants didn't have any of that. And basically they were looked down upon. And the way for merchants to build a great civilization is to, I think, create legitimacy through beauty and reviving on like history and culture and create this like renewed vision of the future that does not feel like completely fake from the past, but it definitely feels new. Like the Italian Renaissance was not a LARP of Greece, but it was severely influenced by it. They were trying to imitate the Greeks in a way and surpass them. That's the key thing. Like the ambition to surpass the great civilizations from the past while like you want what you want is for the Greeks of antiquity to look at the stuff like we built and they feel like we are the natural inheritors of their tradition, but at the same time we surpass them. That's like one of the most ambitious things a civilization can aspire to do, and that's what we should be aiming for.
All right, freaks, you know me, you know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No games, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game.
If you've been stacking for years and need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out.
What's up, freaks? When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their motto is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
How do you guys feel about the current state of the tech sector in SF and like the different directions? I mean, you mentioned like closed source software and open source. And I think obviously it's a bit played out at this point, but it'd be remiss not to bring it up, like the slopification of the internet stemming from the innovations happening around AI in San Francisco specifically and other parts of the world, but predominantly San Francisco. It's like, how do we make sure that we're, I mean, it's inarguable, this technology is incredibly beneficial for humanity if understood how to wield, if you understand how to wield it properly. But like, to that point, how do we push people towards wielding it properly and then designing a physical space around that, that sort of respects the progress that we're making as a civilization and sort of enshrines it in the physical landscape while also using the digital world to advance humanity at the same time.
Yeah, that might be one of like defining questions of our time. Like, how do you wield like AI? I don't have the answer to that yet, but I think there's still room to do stuff in the physical world, not just in the digital one.
Well, what's your hunch? How's it being wrongly wielded right now, and who's wielding it properly, in your opinion?
I have a soft spot for open source, but I always, like, one day I wake up and think, like, yeah, open source is like the way to the promised land. Other days I wake up and it's like, yeah, but like it can also get like, it has all these dangers. If you open source like the most advanced frontier models, maybe not current ones, but maybe the ones in next year, that could be dangerous. Do you want to, Marty, do you mind open sourcing how to like make nuclear bombs, or rather, let's say, how to make the stealth technology on the B-2 bomber? Would you mind if other, like anyone figure out how to make B-2 bombers? As an American, maybe you'd say like, no, we don't want that. So it is not an easy question, but I still have a soft spot in my heart for open source. So I'll say that I think it's probably best to open source a bunch of stuff.
I would agree there. DC, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, man. I think there's this fascinating role inversion where right now the best open source AI models are actually Chinese, and they're only a few months behind the you know, state of the art. They're maybe as good as Claude and ChatGPT and the Opus series was, call it 3 to 6 months ago. So very funny situation that, like, you know, sort of the freedom software is coming from there. I would really like to see that switch around again in the future. Like, that's spiritually, I feel like that's spiritually our job. I think, you know,
you mentioned Spencer Pratt earlier. He had, I'm sure you've seen, you know, a lot of real banger campaign videos, some of them AI generated. So I really think it's just a force multiplier. Like, and, you know, people talk about like, oh, how do you prove that you're human? Things like that. I think that's sort of beside the point. It's like the slop comes from people, like it always has. And the people who want to post slop now have tools that let them post a lot more slop. Whatever, you know, we're going to have good tools to filter out the slop and not look at it. And the thing that's magical to me is like the people who want to make, you know, have actually something to say, who have something to build, they get the force multiplier too. You know, Pablo and I have each done some renders where we take, for example, a picture of a certain part of SF. And then, you know, you go back and forth with the model a bunch until you've like turned it into like what it should look like. And you post the before and after. People really respond to that. So there's a lot of like, you know, just really great sort of like creative powers.
Yeah. And I mean, to that point too, I mean, we have like a real world example of this in El Salvador. I'm sure you saw the drone videos of the before and after San Salvador and the restoration of the capital.
Yes.
And it is, and like that proves it is possible. It's just where is the will going to come from? And to that point, like, do you feel the momentum building in favor of those of us who would like to see these beautiful pieces of architecture return to the world?
Pablo, you wanna do this one?
Yeah, I really like what they're doing on like down in El Salvador. I think it's very promising. I mean, I come from a country that is.
Oh no, we might have lost him.
Okay, I'll just keep going because it might be locally recorded. But I really like what they're doing in El Salvador. I mean, I come from a country that is like written with violence. And I'm really glad that the people of El Salvador now enjoy peace. And now the focus has shifted of like, can we make it affordable and beautiful? And I think that's the correct move. If this is not investment advice, but I would probably would want to invest in El Salvador going forward. Like, it's just, like, it just seems like it's going to keep improving. It seems like they have competent leadership that cares. And they have proven that they can get stuff done. So, I'm very bullish on that.
Yeah. I mean, to your question directly about, like, is there, like, momentum building for this kind of thing? You know, I really think there is. Like, you look at some of the before and after posts on Twitter, they're really resonating with more people than maybe I would have guessed. And I think, you know, it's kind of cliche at this point, but like it's factual. Like, a lot of like younger people are not really buying into the sort of like previous generation ideal of like, you know, go to, you know, college, be in the city for a little bit, and then you go and just like live in the suburbs for the rest of your life. That's where you go when you want to start a family. I think there's a lot of people now who actually like, they want to have kids and they want to have them like in the city. And for that to work, you know, your bar for quality just becomes much higher. You know, like if I'm by myself and there's bad stuff going on in the street, it's not ideal, but I can just like, you know, walk by it. You know, if you have kids, you know, you don't want them to like have that kind of like callousness like baked into their experience. You don't want them to be exposed to danger. You know, you need to have like an actual like aspirational growing city. You need to be building a lot more so that they can live there and they don't have to like move out when they grow up. And so I think there's a lot more people who think this way now.
Yeah. I mean, and to not necessarily directly to that point, but as we've been talking, I can't stop thinking about Strong Towns. I think that's the book I've read. The one book I've read in the last decade that has affected me the most, funnily enough, because it's always on my mind, particularly when talking about subjects like this. But to that point, like, the sort of core thesis of that book is that cities are quasi-living organisms that, if designed properly, are done so because it's an emergent property that just arises from the natural development of commerce and community that emerges from that particular locality. Yep. And to that point, like, how do we make sure that this is done the right way, like emergent and natural, and not sort of diktat centrally planned, like, we need beautiful buildings, so we're going to build them here, here, and here.
Let me give you a counter example to that, though. Like, you know, you've heard of Haussmann's renovation of Paris, which was a big project in the 19th century. They had, you know, a bunch of sort of infrastructure problems, you know, like transportation was really hard. Getting around the city was hard. They had, you know, sort of like waterways that weren't clean. And he went in, and it was it was somewhat top down. It was like a master plan thing. That whole, you know, now like very iconic system of like roundabouts, boulevards, grand arches, and the, you know, Haussmann style apartment buildings. That doesn't mean you have to like, you know, like nuke everything and start over. But I think, you know, the emergent stuff, it's like one of those things where, you know, you drop an artificial reef and then like the big, beautiful ecosystem kind of grows on it. You have to set the like bones of it, like in the right spot for it, all of this emergence to be able to happen. You know, you talked earlier about like, hey, there's all these nice Victorians that people don't want to touch. And that's true. There's also huge areas of SF, actually, less well known, that are, you know, sort of just like one story, you know, stucco buildings with like a driveway going into each garage. It looks like the Simpsons intro. It's like, it's not what this a city should be. And so I think there's actually like a lot of room to like do some bulldozing and Haussmannizing, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's funny because I think a lot of, I was going to say, like, I think a lot of Philadelphia's landscape is inspired by that French restoration. Like, if you look at Benjamin Franklin Parkway leading up to the Art Museum, it's very French inspired.
Yeah. And that you mentioned, like, I think the things we're working on like this project and like many of these ideas we're trying to push are not only for San Francisco. We are we have an ongoing project with our group that we're working on a little book called the Little Orange Book, that is going to be this nice international red, international orange color, that is the color of the Golden Gate Bridge and the color of like San Francisco Giants, sort of like this iconic color of San Francisco. And basically, it'll be just our ideas on how to improve the city, and also what are the ideas that can be exported to other cities that want to be the cities of the, like, cities of the future. And you'll hear more about that in the future.
I can't wait to read it, to get my hands on it. And that's what I love, the very narrow focus on San Francisco too. That's where I think a lot of people make mistakes, where they try to fix everybody's problems at once. And I think that's something that I've definitely become more convinced of, is you're not going to solve the world's problems. Focus on your local community, the city you live in. And I think more and more people need to do that. And I think you two are examples of this. We've mentioned about like Spencer Pratt being an example of, hey, like, I'm going to focus on LA. We're going to make this better. We need more of that. And I think it was a bit of a rhetorical question, because I think it's obvious that the momentum is building in this direction, and we're sort of in the discovery phase of how you go from zero to one in terms of implementing it. And I think one of the great examples of this is just all the aesthetic accounts on X that have gone crazy, have gotten crazy popular in the last 5 years. I think during COVID is when they really took off. And again, not that we're trying to create the Renaissance Fair, but I think a lot of people trying to inspire others to think about beauty. And it's becoming clear. My wife, for example, she went out and she found a bunch of, I think she found like 200 Architectural Digest from the 80s and early 90s that we have on the bookshelf, and we've just been thumbing through those for the last couple of weeks. And it's insane how some of these design principles are eternal and Lindy. Like, it's just a few simple things that you need to do for a room or a building or a street, whatever it may be, that can make it beautiful. It's not like we're trying to develop new physics here. These are sort of learned practices that have been around for millennia that we just have temporarily lost in our modernity.
I would say that we should basically try to balance these two things. Basically, I'm against sort of like this sort of like, I don't know if you know this style, sort of like Zaha Hadid sort of like parametricist that is sort of like very alien. I really like the ambition of trying to make buildings that have never been before, but I don't like the idea of like rejecting objective beauty and sort of like these eternal values. Now, I'm also against like the traditionalist. I don't make friends on any side because the traditionalist is sort of like, which is going to like, you know, no new physics. You know what? Actually, Marty, I do want to discover new physics. That would be insane. We should discover new physics. And on the modernist sort of like buildings, like I think I like the fact that we should be making, you know, affordable buildings that are cheap, like are like entry level for people that are not rich. I don't want to use the word cheap, but they're ugly, and the buildings that are ugly should be torn down. So I'm a different kind of, this is not YIMBY. This is neo YIMBY. All the ugly buildings will come down when we win, Marty. They will all come down, and we will build beautiful, affordable buildings. Beautiful, affordable buildings.
No, but I agree with you. I want new physics too. I want new designs. But there, like to your point, objective beauty is objective, and you know it when you see it. And we need to get back to that. I cannot wait to tear down all the ugly buildings. There's a ton of them.
The future must look like the future.
Yeah,
correct,
gentlemen. This has been an absolute pleasure. I mean, it started with exchanging food stamps for fentanyl and ended on a very high energy aesthetics talk here. I know you got to run. What should we leave the freaks with? What parting messages should we give the audience?
Well, I'm sure we'll plug the socials, but I'm, you know, Pablo Antonio and most social media. You should tune in into what the future should look like and what should we do about it, and just not just be a spectator. Like, the future doesn't just unfold. Like, it needs to, it's driven by will, and it's in individuals. And there's like nothing else compares to that. And that's the only way out.
Yeah. Totally. I think the big thing that we want to create is we want to get the civic ambition back. America used to have so much of this, by the way, 100 years ago in spades, like in Philly, in New York, and all kinds of places, in Cleveland. It's like, you know, it's not just like, oh, make things a little less bad. Like, you know, we actually like have the resources and the sort of like the high energy people to like make it really great. And so it's got to be, like, that has to be the bar. We're going to write the little orange book.
All right, gentlemen, I can't wait for the little orange book. And I agree. It's your civic duty to build a beautiful future. Go do it.
Thanks so much for having us. This was great.
Thanks, Marty.
Thank you, guys. Peace and love, freaks.
Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free. Helps the show,
gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.